Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to NJSBA's Blog Talk Radio Show, Conversations on New Jersey Education, a program dedicated to creating a conversation among those of us in the education community and beyond on important education issues of the day. A conversation that brings the state leaders to you, and I hope you all feel free to join in on the conversation. My name is Ray Pinney, and I'll be your host this morning for this edition. Today we will obviously be taking your calls, and we will have the chat room open. To let you know how this works, I will ask Christy to give an overview.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Now, if you want to call in, just dial 1-347-989-8904. And if you are ready to make a comment or ask a question, just push the button number 1 on your phone. That will indicate that you have something to say. I'll get your name and your question or topic, and we will put you on the air. Now, if you're just listening on your computer, we do have a chat room feature that you can log into. We'll be monitoring the chat room, and we'll pass on some of your comments or questions to our speakers. To log into the chat room, you will need to register with Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks, Christy. This past Tuesday, Governor Christy gave his state budget address, and unlike past budget addresses, the revenue forecasts were a bit rosier. So rosy that Governor Christie believes that he can increase spending without raising taxes. In fact, he believes he can lower taxes. In education, Governor Christie wants to increase funding by $213 million for public education, though it should be noted that not all districts will be affected the same way. How that's going to be affected at the time of this show, we do not have the individual numbers. I would also like to point out that Governor Christie, as he first pointed out in the State of the State address, wants to push his education reform agenda, and that means programs like the Opportunity Scholarship Act and tenure reform, two issues that we'll discuss later. I am very pleased to have with us this morning two individuals who I know listen to the budget address and the State of the State with discerning ears. They are two individuals who represent the two education associations well in the State House and have a good pulse for what may or may not happen in the upcoming months. They are the Director of Government Relations at NJEA, Ginger Goldschnitzer. Welcome, Ginger.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, our pleasure. And NJSBA's own Director of Governmental Relations, Mike Brancic. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning, Ray.
Great to have both of you here. Let's start on our thoughts on the governor's budget address. I'll go to you, Mike. He's, at least from what I'm looking at, he's pretty optimistic that there's going to be a lot of growth in the revenue. Where's that growth coming from?
That's a good question. right now, he's showing a significant increase in revenue from the gross income tax. Whether that will actually occur, we won't know until sometime in April when the actual tax returns are due. Most people who owe money, which is generating the revenue for the state, don't make their payments until they have to, which is typically in late March and early April. So generally, we have a better sense of what the revenue numbers look like when we actually have the collection data in, and that's probably sometime about 6 to 8 weeks from now.
And if I read correctly, it looks like he's actually looking for revenue increase almost across the board in most of the tax areas.
Yeah, he is. And like I said, they have their own research economist in the Division of Taxation, and they've made some assumptions here about where the economy is going. And I'm looking at some of the information he distributed. Basically, the key revenues are the income, the sales tax, corporation business tax. He shows income taxes up by 6.3%. Sales tax is up 4.7%. Corporation business tax is up almost 11%. The net increase for the major revenue categories is 7.3% projected into next year. So, I mean, is that going to materialize? We can only hope.
Ginger, Governor Christie has criticized past governors for being too rosy in their projections and revenue. Has he fallen into the same trap from your perspective, or are you just going to take him at his word?
You know what? Time will tell. I don't have my crystal ball in front of me. I'm not great at projecting revenues. I would certainly defer to Mike's expertise on that matter. But, you know, it's interesting the timing of when he's making this leap of faith, if you will, about increased revenues. I mean, I guess we're starting to see some comeback in the economy. The question is will it really be sustained, and how will these tax cuts be paid for in the event that it doesn't happen? What will he have to cut to make up for the fact that revenue doesn't come in as strong if necessary?
And, Mike, he's making his revenue projections with the 10% – with the sales tax – I mean, income tax decrease too, right?
Yeah. The basis of his budget proposal assumes that a 10% cut in the income tax would be phased in over 3 years. So the value next year of the reduction in revenues is about $345 million. If revenues grow to the tune of he's posting an increase in next year over this year of about $705 million, according to his budget chart, and that's after the reduction of one third. So he's talking about $1 billion increase in essentially in income tax revenues, and you have to remember that a big portion of our income tax revenues come from capital gains and dividends. So the big indicator right now is in part job growth, but also what's happening on the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's so volatile that if things that are out of everybody's control, international things, change that impact the market negatively, some of these increases would probably have to be adjusted. The money that comes in from the state income tax goes directly into something called the Property Tax Relief Fund, which is the lion's share, the mainstay of money that goes to public education. So if in fact these revenues don't materialize, it brings into question whether we can sustain the increases he's projected for school aid next year.
Ginger, the governor made a point that two points. One, that he's increasing aid to public education by $213 million. How that's distributed, we can only guess at this point. But he also made the point that it's we're spending more on public education now than ever before. Is that accurate from your perspective?
I guess that you could look at it that way, but let's remember that the governor has attempted to starve schools in the first part of his term through dramatic decreases in aid, like $1.3 billion when he first came into office, and then he coupled that with a tight property tax cap. So I think that one of the arguments the governor made when he came into office was that the reason that, you know, it was such a large decrease is because there was a federal component, there was federal funding that he wasn't going to make up at the state level. So, sure, numbers are funny things, and you could look at it. He could make an argument that this is the highest amount of state aid. I think that you can argue that given the dramatic cuts in the tight property tax cap, that it's not enough. I've learned not to look a gift horse in the mouth. I'm certain that any additional funding will benefit our students and our schools because many of them have really been hurting these last couple of years. To them, it won't even matter that the governor went to court to avoid having to provide a lot of this money to urban schools.
Mm-hmm. There's also a possibility, though, that I assume that some districts will not get an increase. I'm not even sure. Do you think anyone would ever get a decrease? Because he's doing a formula based or some type of formula.
Yeah, I've heard. I mean, I don't know. Rumor has that there'll be like 2/3 of the districts will be winners and 1/3 losers. But as I said, that's just a rumor that I heard around the state house.
So, Mike, from our NJSBA's perspective, what would be a really good formula? Obviously, one that gives everyone more money. But you know, what would be a concern of us in this new aid?
I guess the there's a couple things. If in fact they do a formula based allocation, it assumes that they'll factor in enrollment, because the fundamental component of the funding formula is a per pupil calculation that drives the numbers that individual districts receive from the state in aid. And to the extent that they haven't used enrollment in the calculations for the last several years, districts that see dramatic fluctuations in enrollment will be beneficiaries or losers. And for those districts who assume that there would be a continuation of the method that's been employed for the last half dozen years, it could create some short-term difficulties, because they're going to have to figure out what they're not going to be able to do, because the last time they ran a formula with enrollment, there wasn't a 2% restrictive levy cap. So if there were significant hits at the local district level, they could make up money by raising their local property tax levy. This is going to be a different game this go-round.
We're talking with Mike Benzik, Director of GR with NJSBA, and Ginger Goldschnitzer, Director of Government Relations at NJEA. If you want to call and ask a question, dial 1-347-989-8904 and press 1 to let us know that you have a question. So that's conjecture, what's going to happen to the individual districts. There's going to be a budget battle. The budget, is it pretty much set as is? Is there going to be a lot of negotiation on this?
Well, I think there's always a lot of negotiation on the budget, and I think that the Democrats are very willing to fight for things, for changes that they believe need to be made to this budget. They certainly came out with strong statements right after his address. So I don't think that it's going to look exactly like this. But, you know, I mean, let's face it, the governor has a pretty good track record of getting a good deal of what he wants. So that should make the spring very interesting for us all.
Mike, what about you? Will the numbers stay about the same?
It really depends on what the revenues turn out to be. If we can assume that the formula calculations that the economists, the research economists use are reasonable, then yeah, I think the budget will be fairly similar. Interestingly enough, Paul Sorrow was interviewed last night on NJ Today, and he said categorically that the Democrats would not push for any new taxes in this next cycle. So the numbers that are the revenue numbers aren't going to be tweaked by any proposed increases in tax revenues like they did in the last several years, where they proposed an increase in the surcharge on people with incomes above $450,000.
Right.
So a lot of discussion is going to be driven by what really materializes in terms of cash in these major revenue accounts. I think that for the most part, this is a hard budget to argue with, in the sense that it does provide additional aid for public schools. I mean, from our vantage point, we would like to get back to where we were at the beginning of SFRA in terms of the net total amount for school aid. But it's hard to say no to more money, even if it's not as much as you ultimately want to have.
Ginger, before I move on from the budget,
Ray, you're breaking up a little bit.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, there you go. Thank you.
Yeah, you're good.
The governor is proposing an income tax cut. Do you think that has any chance? It seems like Democrats were pretty adamant on that.
Yeah, you know, it was a political win for the governor. I, you know, if he gets it, then he delivers an income tax cut. And if he doesn't get it, he can say that the Democrats stood in the way of people's property tax relief. So I don't think that there was any harm for him in proposing it. The Democrats will have already started to stake out some ground on this, and I think this one is close to call. I think you have some pretty. I think the Democrats have put themselves pretty far out there, so they'll give him a run for the money on it.
Mike, do you think the tax cut?
I agree with Ginger, but I think, once again, you know, in the last 10 years, the governor points out property taxes have gone up 70%. But in years when the school funding formula was funded fully, property taxes didn't go up hardly at all. To the extent that the revenues materialize, I think the Democrats would be hard pressed not to go along with the income tax cut. But I think that the point that they're going to make all along is that the amount that the average family is going to get from a 10% reduction is not nearly as much as it would appear to be.
I agree with Mike. It's going to definitely be about fairness, and everybody's looking toward the 2013 election. I think the Democrats are going to be driving home that fairness argument, that this is not nearly as beneficial to middle-class families as it is to millionaires. And,
yeah, that was pretty evident.
Yeah.
Everything heretofore has been based on some perception that things need to be progressive, and people need to contribute based on their ability to contribute. This income tax cut is almost the exact opposite of that. The more you pay in, the more you get back. And obviously that makes sense. But from the vantage point of real tax relief, if according to some of the numbers I've read, that people who are close to the median income in New Jersey probably pay somewhere in the vicinity of an amount that would generate probably $80 in terms of a net income tax reduction. I mean, I'd take $80 if somebody gave it to me, but I'm not going to go out and buy a new car with that or do massive renovations to my home. I'm not going to plan a big family vacation. So, I mean, in perspective, $80 is money, but it's not money that I think is going to turn the state's economy around.
Okay, we'll be switching gears. Ginger, I can't let this pass, but the governor didn't offer the NJEA an olive branch. He took a little jab at your association with the "life is not fair" quote. What do you think of that?
You know, this sort of dog bites man at this point. This is hardly the first time the governor has singled out NJEA and its leadership in a major public address, and I'm sure it's not going to be the last. The governor acts as though taking a jab at NJEA in a public address is an acceptable substitute for a serious policy discussion with us about issues that educators, parents, students, and communities care about a lot. And he's wrong about that. It's not a substitute. Sound bites and YouTube moments don't provide solutions to real challenges that we should be discussing. You know, things like, how do we overcome the impact that abject poverty has on student achievement? How can mentoring and professional development be used more effectively to improve teacher quality? How do we get more parents involved in their own kids' education? And regardless of whether the governor chooses to speak with us about these issues directly or just in sound bites, NJEA has been and remains committed to addressing them. I mean, that's why we funded the Education Law Center, which fought for decades to put in reforms that work for urban kids, like early childhood education and early literacy and after-school programs and tutors and family involvement. That's why NJEA put $2 million into creating the New Jersey Center for Teaching and Learning, which is this now internationally renowned laboratory for teaching science and math. I mean, we've helped kids in Newark, Paterson, Jersey City outperform the best students in this state in AP Physics with that program. And now we're right now working with schools in 12 low-income districts through our Priority Schools program. 12 schools are being selected as we speak, and NJEA is going to pour resources, staffing, creativity, and effort into building stronger connections between those schools and their surrounding communities so their communities can more effectively advocate for those schools. So, you know, while NJEA has been working to improve conditions in urban schools, the governor cut school spending by $1.3 billion in his first year. Urban districts were the hardest hit. And then about a year ago, he and his lawyers went to the Supreme Court to argue that the cuts didn't violate the formula. He lost. And so, you know, it's dog bites man. NJEA has staff and members working every day in the most challenging environments in New Jersey, from Camden to Paterson to Trenton, working hard with the students there those students are facing some tall odds because of poverty. And what has Christie done? He's basically seized on one phrase in an interview that our executive director did and tried to create an entire misinformation campaign around it. I think the reason is to distract from his record.
So I guess I'm not going to take this as an olive branch from you either. Let's move on to some other issues, because he did, in his budget address, he still is beating the same drum on education reform and a lot of the same issues that he did last year. One of them, he says he wants the Opportunity Scholarship Act. And I know the two associations are probably pretty close on their views on this, on that, and also on charter schools. Mike, where is the Opportunity Scholarship Act now? I mean, there's been so many versions, I lose track.
I'm not even sure that a version of that has been introduced yet in this session.
No, it hasn't been reintroduced just yet.
Yeah. At the end of the last session, there was a lot of discussion about making some modifications in terms of reducing the size of the pilot, et cetera. And then along came the Urban Hope Act, and that seemed to take center stage. And as everybody knows, that was passed at the end of the lame duck session. The Opportunity Scholarship Act is problematic for us for a couple of reasons. In the context of this discussion about revenues, the state doesn't generate enough revenue now to cover the cost of in income tax, to cover the cost of education and the other property tax relief programs. So they need to augment that spending with money from other revenue sources. The Opportunity Scholarship Act would take away corporation business tax money and put it into a special fund, which ostensibly would reduce educational costs in local districts by reducing the number of students who attended schools in those districts. But I think the devil's in the details, and to say categorically that it's going to relieve the cost of educating kids in some districts isn't clearly accurate. The other big issue we have with that is that a subset in the last iteration of the Opportunity Scholarship Act, the subset of the money that was made available for students who are eligible for scholarships would take money that would otherwise go into public education and put it into private schools. And we're adamantly opposed to the concept from the vantage point that the day after the school aid formula, whatever formula you want to talk about, is fully funded and districts get exactly what the law says they should get, if there's additional resources available to provide subsidies to private schools, we wouldn't be opposed to that. But we want the public schools fully funded first before we see money diverted to private schools.
Ginger, your association's thoughts on the Opportunity Scholarship Act?
Yeah, I would agree with what Mike said about the mechanics of the bill and its, you know, potential or their alleged savings. I would add that accountability is a huge factor for us. The money would be flowing to these private schools, and yet the children who sit in the chairs in those private schools aren't subject to the same testing. Their teachers are not required to be certified. We have no way the money would go there whether or not these particular schools have any experience or any proven success in educating children facing the challenges that would be attending as a result of this act. The other troubling part of the bill last time around is that there was a whole 25% of the money was set aside for children already attending private schools. So if the purpose of the bill was to, quote-unquote, take children out of failing public schools and put them in private schools, it was really going to fund 25% of the money was going to fund children who were already sitting in private schools. Accountability is a huge factor for us.
Despite both associations opposing this and probably would oppose it in almost any variation, it seems to me that each year it gets a little bit closer, each session. Do you think they'll, Ginger, do you think they'll try to make changes to it so that it somehow gets passed, even if it's a mild version of a voucher bill?
I've heard that they're going to be scaling it down significantly and going back to sort of where they came from with a smaller number of districts. But I think that a lot has happened since a few months ago when these bills were being considered in committee. The Urban Hope Act was signed into law. There was legislation signed into law that would allow for the conversion of high-performing private schools into public charter schools. No one can say anymore that children in urban districts even don't have choices or options. We have charter schools, we have inter-district public school choice, we have intra-district public school choice programs like vocational schools and magnet schools. We're going to have Renaissance schools, Renaissance school projects through the Urban Hope Act in three communities, and we have the ability for private schools to convert to public charters. So at what point is this about choice? Really, and what to what extent is it really about, you know, providing some additional money to folks who are sending their kids to private schools at public expense?
Mike,
I don't know if that answers the question about
no.
the chances, but I would say that given all of the legislation that's passed in the last few months, I think that wounds some of the biggest arguments in favor of the Opportunity Scholarship, and so it may handicap it a bit.
Okay, Mike, what about you? I know the Assembly might be the house where it has the harder chance of passing through.
I think there's a perception out there that there's a subset of kids in urban districts who want educational alternatives, and this appears to create another viable alternative. You know, I think it's something to be cautious with, because this idea essentially of this it essentially is a kind of a voucher program, and you know, I mean, at some point there seems to be places around the country where that's a popular item now, but putting money in the hands of individual students or their parents and giving them the opportunity to go to the schools that they want assumes that there are going to be schools that they can get to that they want to get to with the amount of money that the voucher provides. I think that's a quantum leap, and I'm not sure that it will actually play out the way it's designed to play out. But notwithstanding that, I think there's a continuum now of education. Public schools are at one end of the continuum, and I guess some form of a charter school is at the other end. And all these discussions are somewhere on that continuum line, and I think that the legislature in that context is interested in doing some limited experiments to see if any of these things provide a reasonable option. One of the discussions that it doesn't ever come to the forefront, at least not that often, is the component of public safety. A lot of kids who want to go to charter schools as opposed to public schools often say, or their parents say, they're afraid to send their kids to the schools because they don't feel safe there. I'm sure the teaching staff in those schools don't feel safe often either. I think there's a subset of issues that need to be unbundled in this discussion and focused on in the context of the things that Ginger talked about in terms of accountability. How's the money actually going to be allocated, and what are these new schools going to provide? And if in fact any of them work very well, what can the public school system learn from them? These are all questions that are speculative, and I think people want to know answers, but until you try something, you're not going to find out any of this stuff.
We're talking with Ginger Gold Schnitzer from NJEA and Mike Vrancic from NJSBA. If you want to call in and ask a question, dial 1-347-989-8904 and press 1, and we'll get you on the switchboard. I heard Senator Sweeney and Senator Tom Kaine said that there's going to be some movement in charter school, looking at the entire charter school authorization process. And is that something that you believe will definitely happen, Ginger?
I think that the charter school law is likely to be revamped a bit. I mean, we saw the Assembly pass the whole package of charter school bills last spring. And most of that legislation hasn't been finalized and had to be reintroduced this session. So I think there'll be renewed interest in it. And by the way, Ray, I think that's another thing that sort of hurts the Opportunity Scholarship Act, is that, you know, if we've made some changes, created some public school choice in different ways, and we create some greater accountability in our charter school law and provide more support for charter schools, administrative supports for sure, that OSA becomes a less attractive option. But I think that we will see charter school legislation this session.
Mike, what about you? You think something?
Yeah,
will...
I think that the 1995 charter school law was based on a series of compromises that worked to get charter schools in place. With the experience that's been earned or gained over the last 15 or 16 years, I think there are a lot of people on various sides of this issue who are willing to sit down and talk about how we can redesign the law to address some of the issues that have emerged that, frankly, people hadn't anticipated or hadn't thought through in 1995. So, yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of discussion about that. And we're anxious, as well as people on the charter school side. I mean, from our vantage point, charter schools are public schools, and charter school trustees receive services from our association, and we view them as part, as I said, of this educational continuum with traditional schools on one side, and the charter schools at the other side. And there needs to be a way to bridge this gap and talk about a system that includes all these alternatives that provides the best opportunities for all our kids in the state to learn. And ultimately, if we can reach some closure on a new piece of legislation that gets us closer to doing that, ultimately this is about the kids in schools And that's what has to be our focus. So, yeah, I think something's going to happen.
Yeah, right, Mike. I was just to piggyback on that a little bit. It's interesting to me, a lot of the discussion about changes to the charter school law has focused on who can authorize them and how do you get into them and, you know, whether communities have a say in whether one comes into their district. But no one has really discussed, and to me this is the larger point, is how do we improve the articulation between regular district public schools and public charter schools? As Mike said, these are public schools. In 1995 or 96, when New Jersey created these, they were intended to be laboratories so that we could, you know, try new things with less restrictions and learn. But, you know, 15 years later, where's that learning? And if we're learning things, we need to translate it. You know, there needs to be a greater articulation between what happens in a charter school and if it's good stuff, can we, you know, implement those programs in a regular district school? And likewise, district schools have a lot to teach charter schools about administration and finance, because early in the law, we've seen a lot of these schools close down because, you know, it's people with a vision and an idea but don't necessarily have the school law or business background to run a school and understand how aid comes in and out and how budgets are created. So I think one thing that we should all strive for is some greater articulation. Kids would benefit from that, charter schools would benefit, and public schools would benefit from that.
That's probably hard to do because isn't it a competition of resources between the host district and the charter school? I mean,
and that's unfortunate. We've made it that way, but it ought not to be that way. I mean, these are public schools, and we should all be playing on the same field here.
I want to switch gears a little bit to an issue that I know that we're going to have some disagreement on. And the governor brought this up as one of the other things in his budget address, and that was tenure reform. Mike, what's the association? Before I want to get into Senator Ruiz's bill, because that's not quite – it's a different animal from our perspective. But what's the association's perspective on tenure reform?
Well, it's not a secret. We have a longstanding policy that suggests that tenure, as we know it, is eliminated in lieu of five-year renewable contracts, which create a kind of a job security. But it's a discussion that has to be held in the context of the pilot that's making its way through some of our schools now for teacher evaluation. Our belief essentially is that if you have a substantive teacher evaluation system, this idea of a five-year renewable contract would work. So where we are on the continuum of reforming tenure is way past some of the current discussions. I know that there's some issues, and the reason why we have tenure has to do with issues, you know, politics with a small p at the local level and so on. And I think that ultimately our policy is what our policy is, and we will continue to advocate for changes that reflect things that our members have adopted from 30 years ago.
Ginger, I know this is a big issue for your association, and you did make a slight change in your policy on it. Are you going to fight hard on these tenure reform?
Sure. You know, NJEA came out with its own plan, and our plan was designed to address the problems that the public often raised about tenure. Basically, the public often says that tenure proceedings take too long and they cost too much. So NJEA's plan attempts to improve the induction process to teaching and address these things. And it does it by adding a year, and I think this is what you're referring to, Ray,
mm-hmm.
You made some changes, adding a year before a staff member can acquire tenure. In other words, we'd move from 3 years and a day to 4 years and a day. The first year that of a teacher's career would become a residency year, where teachers would be provided with additional mentoring and support at a time when they need it most. It's important to note that only two out of every five newly hired certified staff in New Jersey, two out of five newly certified staff in New Jersey do not get tenure in the district where they start. So we already have a pretty rigorous induction process. But, you know, we know NJ has done a lot of studies of what we call early leavers, people who leave the teaching profession within the first 5 years. And sometimes it's because of the money. When more lucrative jobs, I should say, are available, they sometimes do that. But regardless of what the economy is like and what the job market is like, we find that these early leavers one of the top reasons for them going is because they need more professional support early in their career. The second thing that we would do in our tenure proposal is to move tenure cases out of the courts and into the hand of arbitrators whose decisions would be final. NJEA's proposal has expedited timelines, and we would make this arbitration binding. In other words, you'd eliminate all the costly appeals through the courts. I think that goes a long way to addressing some of the concerns, and I know that it's not everything or perhaps even anything that School Boards Association has in their policy, but I think we can all agree that shorter and cheaper is better.
Before I go on, my follow-up, we have a question from a caller, and we're going back on charter schools. Jim O'Neill?
Right.
Hey, Jim, how are you? You have a question on charter schools?
Well, I was concerned about the willingness to go forward with a lot of charter schools when every study I've seen says up to 83% of charter schools do not perform as well as public schools, even in the same areas. And so why we're not more concerned about putting more rigorous standards before we're going to divert public school money to those charter schools which have very little evidence except isolated cases of being successful.
I'll put you on hold, Jim, and you can hear their response. Mike, you want to respond to?
I'll go first. I mean, I think Ginger hit the nail on the head with the discussion of accountability, and clearly, in the context of your question, I think one of the big issues is making sure that the standards of performance of charter schools are equal to the standards of performance for public schools. That being said, I think there's also another issue, and that is this sort of global, we're going to create as many charter schools as we can scenario has been somewhat mitigated to now let's look at educational alternatives, including charter schools, in districts that have very bad track records. And I think it points to a larger discussion about other things. If students in certain districts aren't consistently performing well by any standard of measurement, there needs to be a focus on what's really the problem. Is it a combination of things? Are charter schools in and of themselves going to turn this around? I don't think there's any evidence that can be completely the cure for issues that have to do with a whole variety of other social and economic issues. But I don't think that you should interpret our suggestion that we want to be engaged in a discussion of a new charter school law to take it that we're endorsing, you know, creating charter schools all over the place. That's not where we are. I think it's important for people in the education establishment to be part of the dialogue in terms of what charter school legislation should look like. In my opinion, one of the biggest impediments to moving forward in a lot of places is this idea of the challenge about losing revenues and losing dollars. I would argue that in a lot of charter schools that are primarily in urban districts, a significant portion of the money that the charter school gets flows from the state through the district to the charter school. If there was a way to create more of a direct funding stream for charter schools, at least for the state portion, I think that might go a long way towards mitigating some of the concern that's raised. But it still begs the question of how you allocate scarce resources between the traditional public schools and the public charter schools in the same town. And that's a big stumbling block.
Ginger, the governor seems to have modified his position because of some of the backlash for charter schools in some communities. Have you noticed the same thing?
Hard to tell. I think that there's been a pretty strong push from the administration, and you know, certainly a lot of public comments about the expansion of charter schools. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know that we've necessarily seen them push back. But you know, just to go to what Jim was talking about a moment ago, what I would like to see is a little more discussion about how we can, you know, monitor and improve quality in charter schools. A lot of the discussion is focused on the who authorizes and the money. You know, let's remember, this is a discussion, it's about resources are always involved, but ultimately it's about the education of students, and it's our job to educate them wherever they're going to go to school, whether it's in a charter school or in a district school.
All right, let's go back to I want to go back to the tenure reform. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Senator Ruiz has the bill that, at least what I hear, is the one that, if anything's going to move on tenure reform, it would be Senator Ruiz's bill. What concerns do you have, Ginger, of that bill? Just one or two. Don't go into the whole bill. It's a big bill, and we don't have much time.
Sure, absolutely. I would say that we're concerned about the way tenure is acquired. Basically, it requires three consecutive effective evaluations. So if administrators could easily always deny you that third consecutive one and keep moving the goalpost on you, you'd have employees who could never get tenure. NJEA believes that if you don't have tenure, if you haven't earned tenure, and if you can't earn tenure and keep it, then you shouldn't have a job. And her bill would allow people without tenure to continue working in our schools. We don't like that it creates different rules for different staff members. We also have a concern about the way tenure can be removed. In other words, it can be removed without providing teacher with the due process protections that make tenure meaningful.
Mike, the Senator Ruiz's bill has a lot of different variations in how schools are governed, too. There are some things I assume the association does like about the bill. What do we like and what do we not like? Just one or two things.
That's the hard one. I can talk more about what we don't like. I think you know, there's this idea that school principals are really the prime movers in the context of the tenure process. The more recent iteration of Senator Ruiz's bill has some amendments over her original version that we like, but I think the idea that there's going to be this global change in the way tenure is granted based on principal recommendations and the recommendations of school improvement panels, it remains unclear how much local boards and superintendents, but local boards mostly, will have to say about the hiring and placement of teachers in districts. I guess the concern that we have about the legislation remains the mutual consent provision and how that will actually work in real practice. I think that it's only going to impact the subset of our districts, but we're in the process of doing a section by section review of the bill. And like I said before, in the context of tenure reform, we're probably further at the end of the spectrum than anyone else in the sense that ideally we wouldn't have tenure as it exists now. We'd have 5-year renewable contracts. Senator Ruiz's bill is moving in a direction that continues tenure in a slightly different fashion than it works now. And I guess the other big issue we have is that all this stuff is contingent upon an evaluation methodology that's been approved through the commissioner's office that will yield the kind of evaluation data that will make it easy to determine whether teachers get, you know, the effective or highly effective performance ratings that will guarantee that they get tenure or a contract renewal. And we have a ways to go before that evaluation system is completely played out.
Great, you do a show just on this.
I was just thinking that. But let's just say Mike brings up a great point, because it depends on – you can't have the tenure reform that Senator Ruiz is looking for without the evaluation model that she indicates somewhere in there that she wants. Is that a concern for the NJEA, I assume?
We're very clear that, in fact, we think we're sort of doing this backwards, right? I mean, evaluation is the process by which you figure out which teachers aren't measuring up and you get them the support that they need. And if you're able to rehabilitate them and get them in the right direction, then they should remain on your staff. And if not, you should, you know, implement, you know, bring tenure charges and put them through tenure, a fair dismissal process. So really, if you want to improve quality teaching, you need to do evaluation and then do tenure. That's not the situation we're faced with right now. And by the way, NJEA also has legislation that we've proposed on evaluation, which I know we don't have time to talk about today.
No, another day. We'll have another tenure discussion. Mike, we're getting towards the end. Any final thoughts on – do you think Senator Ruiz's bill is the one that if there's any movement, it'll be there?
I would assume so. I mean, right now she's reintroduced the bill. It hasn't been scheduled for a hearing as of yet. I think the next time the Senate Education Committee meets is technically March the 5th. Whether or not it'll be on the agenda that day remains to be seen. I don't know that there's consensus in the legislature in the context of the Senate on that bill, and or if the Assembly is even willing to consider any iterations right now. But, I mean, that's something that I'm just not privy to. I think there will definitely be a discussion of tenure reform, and I think Senator Ruiz's bill will most likely be the focal point of the discussion. Whether that bill moves or whether some hybrid moves, we'll see.
Okay, thank you. That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you, Ginger, for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Mike, thanks, as always, for joining
us. Thanks, Ray.
And that brings us to the end of another conversation in New Jersey Education. And I thank all of you for listening, and I'm sorry I couldn't get to your question, Mark. And, bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.